Starting off hour number two, I'm Jim Rome. Welcome to the jungle. Carlos Pena will be joining me momentarily. This show, as you know, is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage is with you every step of the way to provide a seamless mortgage experience and quick reaction to that phone call at the end of hour number one. Bill in Tampa, except he did correct me and say, actually, it's Bill in Champa. Ryan in Sacktown tweets, Snagger, Bill's take was garbage. The Rays actually had the advantage. They're used to playing with under 15,000 fans in the stands every day.
Garbage!
That's a good point. More reaction coming up momentarily, but as promised, we are joined right now by a 14-year MLB vet, an all-star, a gold glove winner, a silver slugger, an AL home run champion, an AL comeback player of the year award winner back in 2007. You can watch Carlos Pena as part of MLB Network's World Series coverage. It's airing before and after every game from Globe Life Field. He joins us right now, Carlos Pena. Carlos, good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, man. Really pumped to be joining you this afternoon. So thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and I'm pumped to have you, too. So going into the series, you would compare this Rays team to the team in 2008 that you were a part of. Can you take me back to 08 first? What made that team so special?
Well, I think we have to go immediately to the history of the franchise at that time, you know, and their young history, really. It was a 10-year losing story. I mean, you think about the fact that first 10 years in the organization, they had never won 60 games. 60! And 2007, that was actually my best year as far as individual stats are concerned. Just a year after, we become what they called us the Beast of the East and arguably the best team in the American League in just a year of a turnaround. I think that's what makes the story so remarkable. And dethroning just these perennial teams that had just continually been to the World Series in the postseason in the Yankees and the Red Sox. So that's what I think the biggest story of it all was, the fact that we went to the World Series after never, ever in the history of the franchise winning 60 games. That is remarkable.
It is. Carlos Pena joining us. That really was remarkable. And that 08 team had established MLB stars, guys like you, Cliff Floyd, Carl Crawford. And that's before we get into the crazy young talent that you guys had on that roster as well. What about this 2020 team? Do they have as many guys who are as established as stars as that group did?
Yeah, not at all. That's, I think, what makes this team very unique and peculiar is the fact that you could argue back in 2007 and going on 2008 that, okay, we didn't have these superstar, you know, high-priced talent, but we had quite a few established big leaguers, you know, in myself, Cliff Floyd, Carl Crawford, pretty good players. And, you know, you could say, even argue that we were stars in some regard. But this ball club right here is just a bunch of good, solid players. And it's not to take away from any of them. But in reality, you don't have that one that stands out and says, oh, that's a bona fide superstar in the big leagues. You cannot find one in that ball club that you could say that about. And that's what makes this team really interesting. But also, I believe that that is precisely why they are so dangerous. It's because they're used to playing that type of baseball where everyone has to contribute and nothing falls on any particular player fully. It's the sum of all parts that makes this ball club very dangerous.
We are talking to Carlos Pena. All right, so Carlos, things did not go so well for the Rays in game one. Clayton Kershaw got through that first inning that was kind of rough, and then he settled in, and then he was rolling. Then the Dodger hitters did their damage. So what do you make of how Tampa Bay played in game one and then how they responded in game two?
You know, game one was sloppy. I thought that Glasnow was all over the place with the placement of his fastball. I thought it was too random the way he was utilizing speed. When, if you asked me, I would have had him throw the fastball pretty much precisely up and in and pound these Dodgers hitters in with the fastball and elevated, not just in, elevated. That would have made his off-speed pitches a lot more effective. That didn't happen. And I thought they came out flat. The bats were not On Q&M, look, I'm going to give Kershaw quite a lot of credit. I mean, it was a tough first inning, but then he made the adjustment. I thought he was flying open early on in the game, and then he was able to close off and utilize that front shoulder almost as a hinge. And you saw the bite in the slider come back. The fastball location was where a little bit better. And obviously that just carried the Dodgers to a win. The offense was locked in for the Dodgers as well. The good thing was that the Rays came back immediately. You know, I thought last night was a must win for the Rays. If the Rays would have found themselves two games behind the Dodgers at this point, you could have said it was pretty much a wrap, in my opinion. So for the Rays to be able to punch back and kind of say, hey, back off of me, I'm not going to be cornered, you know, it's so important. And now they're sitting looking forward to practically a best-of-five series with pretty much the entire setup as far as the pitching is concerned. You know, with this rest day here, Cash has a lot of options. So this is best-case scenario for the Rays after the way the game one went.
See, I'm glad you said that. I could not agree with you more.
Well, right now.
That was a must-win game. Excuse me, Carlos. I'm glad you said it, because when you've got Blake Snell on the mound and the Dodgers are going with Tony Gonsolin and followed by a bunch of relievers and they've lost game one, they had to win that game. To me, that definitely was a must-win game. What was your reaction when Brandon Lau went deep in the first inning? And then how big of a moment was that for the Rays, not just in the game but in the entire series?
Jim, that's absolutely huge, because Brandon, it's one of those pillars in that lineup, and he had not been performing. You know, let's just be quite honest. He's been struggling during the postseason. And a lot of times, you know, when we look at hitters, we start thinking, oh, what's wrong with his swing? Well, let me tell you that usually what we're looking at is symptoms. You know, when we see swings break down, it's not because the swing itself is wrong. It's because the timing is wrong. So we got to go to the root of the problem. And I thought he made a great adjustment yesterday at getting ready earlier. He's been late on fastballs, fouling pitches off, even though you're like, wow, I was right on that fastball, I just missed it. No, you were late. You were a few degrees late, a few clicks late. And I thought he did a better job of getting ready early enough to catch up to those fastballs. Yes, they were out over the plate, so, you know, pitchers did not locate the way they should have, but the swing was so crisp and smooth and natural. And look, let's talk about what it does to the ball club to see their best hitter, you know, arguably, perform. I mean, it is absolute a huge boost for the ball club, for the offense, and now they're sitting with confidence that they can go forward and really compete with this very important lineup that the Dodgers have.
Carlos Pena is joining us. All right, so what about Randy Arozarena? When you watch him play and the way he's broken out this postseason, I mean, like, Carlos, the ball just explodes off this guy's bat. As one hitter watching another, what sticks out to you the most in terms of how he's able to barrel up the ball consistently?
Jim, I'm going to dive in a little bit deeper, you know, as far as hitting is concerned. I think sometimes we look at, you know, like, oh, hand-and-eye coordination, you know. And yes, we do need hand and eye coordination to be great hitters in the big league level. But I'm not concerned about hitters in the big leagues actually intersecting the pitch line. You know, that's always done. The key is to actually do it at the right time. That's why hitters, when they have that loopy swing, it's very difficult to make contact, because if you're not on time, you're swinging and missing. All right. Well, Randy Arozarena is one of these guys that have a very, very flat swing. So he's got two things going for himself. He is on the pitch line for a very, very, very long time, more than most. So forget about swinging up. I don't believe in that launch angle thing. If you are thinking about it in terms of swinging up, launch angle happens after you hit the baseball. All right? And Arozarena gets on the pitch line immediately. So that gives him a lot of margin for error. Now, if you add to that very good timing, then the production just comes. It is just exactly what happens when you have that perfect formula. And Randy Arozarena has been doing precisely that. On the path, on line with the pitch, and on time. That is the perfect formula for success and as an offensive player and as a hitter.
I'm glad you went deep on that. Carlos Pena joining us. All right, so Carlos, Tampa Bay is famous also in the way they handle their bullpen, and they're not afraid to shake up their lineup either. In the past, a lot of relievers would prefer to have a specific role, either as a setup man or a specialist or a closer. The Rays, of course, do not take that approach. How has Kevin Cash and the rest of the organization gotten everybody to buy in and be prepared to deliver no matter what role they're given?
And I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I think traditionally we've seen guys who, hey, man, I want to make sure I get to the park, and I'm hitting fourth. You know, I'm cleanup. I don't even look at the lineup. I know where I'm hitting. That used to be the narrative. And then people and players, you know, used to always say that that's what they would prefer. But here we are in a totally different style of play. I think we can say that about both ball clubs. You mentioned the different lineups. 59 different lineups for the Rays during the regular season. 57 for the Dodgers. They have the same style of play, even though the money they spend is totally different. I mean, it's lopsided in that regard. But Cash has done a great job of communicating to players the importance of everyone just contributing. And it's remarkable to me, so important to me, to see how everyone has bought in. In essence, if you are a pitcher for the Tampa Bay Rays, you are not designed any specific role. Your job is to put out fires or to prevent the house from getting on fire. All right, that is your role. It is very ambiguous, which means that at any moment, you could be called upon to put out a fire or preventing the house from getting on fire. That is the mentality of the entire pitching staff. And if you are a hitter, you're there to do damage. You're there to go on a search and destroy mission. Where? You know, where, what, who, what is the target? It doesn't matter to you. You're ready to be deployed. And if I'm allowed, you know, well, with respect, you know, to talk in military terms, I'm just ready to be deployed whenever. I don't know what my job is. I'm looking for my target, and I'm going to destroy it. And that's your job as a hitter, regardless whether you're hitting leadoff, cleanup, or last. It does not matter.
I love that analogy always, man. Targets. Targets. Just knock down your targets. Find your target. Lock it on the target. Carlos, what if you're an opposing hitter? How much does your approach to the game change when you know you're going to see a different pitcher every single time you step to the plate?
Well, it should change, right? It should change, Jim. But unfortunately, I would say, as I look at hitters, they're behind in that sense, because they are not preparing to hunt the pitcher. So in other words, you can go in an 162 game season and pretty much set parameters, you know, as far as variables are concerned. I'm going to get deep again into hitting, but and this is the thing. I've had experience, so I'm talking about the application, but also now that I'm retired and just solely studying this, I also have the theory and the science behind it to match what I'm talking about. If you just set parameters and basically you say, I'm just going to look away, react in, and that's your approach during the World Series, a short series, you know, you may never get that pitch within the parameters that you've set. In the 162-game season, you will get some pitches in that area enough to put up pretty decent numbers. But in a short series, you better get out there and hunt the pitcher that's on the mound. How? You have to know what they throw. You have to know what pitch they go to. And you have to sit on these pitches. And not only that, be ready for the speed of those pitches so that your timing is on par for those. That's how you defeat, you know, these really tough pitchers on both sides, really. I mean, because both teams have great, great pitching. You can't just go up there and default guys, you know, especially in the postseason and these short series. You have to have a plan and a strategy. And it better change. You have to sit on pitches. You cannot try to hit everything, cover the whole entire strike zone. You want to be the master of one pitch instead of being, you'll cover everything, which you will not be able to do. All right. So it's very key to come up with a very specific strategy.
All right, so now, Carlos, you just said that in retirement now you have a chance that even though you have the experience and the application, you can study this more. But it seems to me you're still doing some hunting, a different kind of hunting. For instance, you still killed for MLB Network, but I want to ask you about some of the work you did in the ALCS. You were on that demo field. You're charging ground balls. You're showing how a first baseman should be stretching. You're doing it all in a suit with the suit jacket buttoned up, and you're making it look really smooth. Almost anybody else would have taken off their jacket, maybe blown out the pants or the jacket buttons trying to run and stretch. Man, exactly how did you do all that?
Hilarious. You know, I always worried about splitting the suit, you know, because I try to wear the fitted, nice fitted suits. You know what I'm talking about, Jim?
Oh, I do.
Like, you know, the Italian nice fitted suit. But, man, I just think it's so important, and I'm very passionate about taking the fans into the game and explaining what's truly happening. And I, Jim, I hate cliches, man. I just hate giving the fans cliches. I want to make sure that I bring substance. So if that means that I have to go ahead and field ground balls with my suit or take some swings with my suit, that's precisely what I'm going to do.
No, and I love that. And you want to make sure that the suit looks good and feels good. So, Carlos, how have you approached it in retirement in terms of working out, maintaining good physical conditioning, nutrition? Did you kind of take the foot off the gas, or do you still live that lifestyle? Because it looks like you do.
Dave, my wife jokes with me all the time. It's like, you're working out harder than you did when you played.
Right, right.
And that is true. To an extent, because when I played, I had to be a little bit more careful because injury was always something that we were trying to prevent. Now I can go a little bit more aggressive. So I'm lifting heavier weight than I ever have lifted. You know, I'm hitting max, you know, maxing out on the bench press, for example. We never bench press when we played. It was just one of those things that we try to stay away from because of the shoulder health and all that. So I'm going harder than ever before. I'm glad you noticed, and that actually motivates me to keep on doing it.
So, Carlos, yeah, exactly. I get that. So let me ask you this then. Why? I mean, do you love it, or do you love what it does for you? Why are you going as hard as you are right now?
Man, I think I missed the competition. And now the competition that is, you know, I can't do it on the field, I do it against myself. It's basically saying, hey, what can you conquer next? You know, what is it? What kind of move can you conquer next? How much weight can you push next? You know, how many pull-ups can you do? And I'm like, well, you wouldn't be able to do that when you were 25, and now at 42, you're doing it? Okay, that's impressive. So I feel like it's a constant trying to push myself to the limit. I absolutely love it. You know, so I love sports. I love fitness and all that. And I think I'm you know, self-disciplined. There's a quote. Someone asked me, like, can you give me a quote? Can you give me a quote to put in the gym, the gym that I go to here, on the club next door? And, the quote was, success is built upon self-discipline. So self-discipline to me has always been key to anything I do. Ever since I was young, it was crazy. I had that in my mind. I think it was instilled by, you know, by my parents. Instilled in me by my parents, and I still live by that motto. So if I ever want to reach new heights, I have to be self-disciplined. So that's why I work out so hard still, Jim.
I absolutely love it. I love the message. Carlos Pena, my guest. Carlos, one last thought, and I've kept you longer than I do any other guest, but I so appreciate the energy and the insight both. The Dodgers have been so good at extending at-bats and even extending innings. With all the runs they've scored with two outs, that is, what kind of a psychological toll does that take on the opposing team when they're extending at-bats and extending innings?
Oh, it's most definitely a factor. As a matter of fact, I'm going to even go back a little bit. One of my concerns with the Rays was the fact that they had a very strenuous, emotionally strenuous series with the Astros. You know, after being three games up and then having to almost, you know, lost the lead and pretty much almost lost the World Series, and they had to come out the ALCS and had to come out and win that game seven, that takes a toll on you. So I was worried about them coming out flat. I thought they came out flat game one in the World Series. The same token, when you have hitters just put up a fight every single AB, it takes so much out of you. It drains you. So there's a lot to be said about the resilience of this Dodger lineup, that pitchers cannot take at-bats off. And this is the thing, Jim. They have to be very economical and frugal with their pitch counts. So you can't have, you know, you can't go 3-2 on every single batter. That's going to totally deplete your arsenal there in the bullpen and in your arms. So you have to be efficient with the way you pitch and the sequencing of your pitches. So that's something to watch out for here as we go forward. Deeper into the World Series.
Could not love that conversation any more than I do. He's a 14-year MLB vet, an all-star, a gold glove winner, a silver slugger, an AL home run champion, an AL comeback player of the year award winner as well. And you can watch Carlos Pena as part of MLB Network's World Series coverage, which is airing before and after every game from Globe Life Field. Carlos, that was awesome. Appreciate you so much. Thank you for doing that.
Jim, it's always a pleasure. Let's make sure we do it again before the World Series is over.
I would love to. I'll take you up on that for sure, Carlos. All right, my man, be good. Let's do it again before the end of the World Series. I could do that conversation after every single game. It's so good. It's always an amazing thing and a great thing when a guest comes on, and the first thing that guest says is, I'm pumped to be here. And they mean it. That didn't surprise me at all. Knowing him and his passion and his energy and his insight, I knew that to be true. But then to show up like that, that is so good. What a great conversation that was. All right, so when we come back at 10:40, 20 minutes from right now, Ariel Helwani will be joining us. We'll talk about the card coming up this weekend. It's a really good one. Will Brinson is coming up. Bill in Champa is taking some. I'll have that reaction for you, too. We've all heard of Casper. You know, the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products at not-so-outrageous prices, from award-winning mattresses to the fluffiest pillows, organic cotton sheets, and all-season duvets. Casper is your one-stop shop for building your perfect bedroom sanctuary. Casper mattresses and bed frames create a solid foundation for a restful night of sleep. Only Casper mattresses are made with 86 supportive gel pods to align your spine and eliminate aches and pains. It is the cooling, supportive comfort that you need to wake up refreshed and ready to roll. Casper bed frames are made from the highest quality materials to ensure that your frame stays looking brand new, even after years of use. It'll look awesome. Casper also has bedroom accessories. And as always, Casper offers free shipping and free returns. Are you ready to build your own bedroom sanctuary? Discover everything you need at Casper.com. Select products. Ineligible for free shipping where indicated. Additional shipping fees apply to Alaska and Hawaii. Terms and conditions do apply. See Casper.com/terms for details.
You're listening to the Jim Rome Show.
Man, I loved everything about that Carlos Pena interview, that conversation. I love his energy. I love his insight. I mean, it's not often you hear somebody break down the swing like that. He's not afraid to jump in and break down a swing mechanically. I thought that was tremendous. And I do love his energy. And the guy looks great. He sounds great. That was tremendous. And then you got idiots like this. Hey, Rome, for being so biased, Dodger Jim, I thought you did a great job with a former Rays player.
I'm going to tell you right now, Mr. Rome, you sound like a homer.
Like he kind of hedged. You sound like a homer. I sound like a homer or I am a homer.
You sound like a homer.
Dodger Jim. Mark Filler tweets, I'm pretty sure that your interview with Carlos Pena not only elevated the show, but took it to space. Thanks. As I now have many more things to watch during the World Series, please get Carlos to guest host next time you go to Wisconsin. Yeah, he is good. I'm going to tell you about it. when you consider all the guys sitting at a desk right now and breaking down Major League Baseball, nobody is better than that guy. Nobody is better than that guy. Johnny Scabs. Hey, Scabs, before I read this, I did warn you, didn't I? I said one more like that, Scabs, and you're done. Scabs tweets, the clones need to cut it out. Jim Rome doesn't root, and neither do we. Signed, Hillbilly's Teeth. Kevin in Detroit tweets, Bill in Champa.
You pronounce Tampa wrong. That's Bill from Champa Bay.
This guy's like, hey, Bill, you pronounced Champa wrong. It's Bill and Champa. Anita can't believe what she's hearing. Skybox Anna 1 is Anita. And she tweets, home field advantage in Arlington, Texas? That's pretty much what I said, Anita. Hey, Bill and Champa. If the Rangers were in the World Series, we can question whether or not it's a neutral field. It's the Dodgers and the Rays in the World Series, and they're playing in Arlington. So how do the Dodgers have the home field advantage? How is that anything but neutral? Hansonian 88 tweets, Dodger Jim sounds bent about Champa Bay guy going in on his team. I can't believe he didn't get run in the first 5 seconds. Don't be bringing that noise around here. You know where the hell you are, chump?
That's Bill from Champa Bay.
Hey, Bill, in Champa Bay. You know who the hell I am?
Champa Bay.
You know who the hell I am, Bill in Champa Bay?
You sound like a homer.
I'm Dodger Jim. You know who the hell I am?
I'm Dodger Jim.
Don't bring that around here.
Champa Bay.
Old Gray Wolf tweets. I'm pumped to be here as well, Jim. Sincerely, the Tubes. Hey, you notice I haven't done a take on the Tubes. The band or the guy. And nor am I going to. We're not talking about the Tube or the Zoom or the band or any of the above. You know who the hell I am. Dodger Jim. Don't you forget it. When we come back, I'm going to change up on you, talk some MMA. It's an amazing fight this weekend on Fight Island. Habib and Gaethje. Ariel Helwani will join me next. We'll break that down. Will Brinson is coming up next hour. Still ahead, my thoughts on Antonio Brown. I thought that I would never, ever have to talk about him ever again. How wrong I was. Not only is the or are the Seahawks reportedly interested, they may not be the only ones. Or AB, Mr. Big Chest, might be running in the NFL again.
Mr. Big Chest.
First up, though, here's a bottom of the hour sport.
Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show on CBS Sports Radio.
Grainger helps your business move forward with supplies and solutions for every industry. Free access to product specialists, safety recovery guys, 24/7 support, and more. So you want to call or click Grainger.com or just stop on by. Dear Rome, you might not have a take on Tubes, but I sure do. Regards, the Juice.
Damn, Jeffrey Toobin. At least Pee Wee Herman was in an X-rated movie theater. I'm just saying.
Well, you know you messed up when the Juice is going in on you.
Damn, Jeffrey Toobin. At least Pee-wee Herman was in an X-rated movie theater. I'm just saying.
Damn, Juice. You liked that, didn't you, Juice? AJ in Delaware was the one who sent that. All right, so set yourselves up. I'm going to talk to Ariel Helwani momentarily, but in the meantime, you can get through 1-800-636-8686. Antonio Brown is on the grid. He's on NFL teams' radars, and the reason for that, he is soon set to come off suspension. So that topic is coming up a little bit later on. As promised, we are joined right now by a journalist for ESPN, host of Ariel Helwani's MMA show, Ariel and the Bad Guy. DC and Helwani, the ESPN MMA Snap Show. He is an NBA sideline reporter. He is a Knicks fan. And yes, he is still a friend of the program. He is Ariel Helwani. Ariel, what's up? How are you?
Jim, a pleasure as always. Why do you say still a friend of the program? Was that ever in doubt?
In the event that anybody forgot or didn't know, or I wanted to emphasize the point. Still a friend. Long has been a friend. Always will be a friend.
Well, I appreciate that. That means a lot, considering I used to listen to you while driving with my mom in Montreal, and she used to love your long and dramatic pauses. So it's still an honor, and it's still surreal that you have me on the show. So thank you once again.
You got it. It's good to have you, and I appreciate the relationship. All right, so we're about 48 hours away from UFC 254. Habib Gaethje, you've been around the sport a long time. Where does this fight stack up among the all-time great fights in UFC history?
On paper, it's a fascinating one. It's certainly intriguing. You know, sometimes we are prisoners of the moment and we say this is the best and that's the best. But when you consider the fact that Habib is 28-0, when you consider how dominant he's been, that he's only lost one round in the UFC to Conor McGregor a couple of years ago, and how good he's looked as a champion, how good he looked in his last fight against Dustin Poirier 13 months ago, and also you consider what he's been through this year, most notably the loss of his father, Abdulmanap, who wasn't just his father, was his mentor and best friend and head coach, all those things and more. And then when you consider Justin Gaethje and how good he has looked, and I believe he's his toughest fight, Khabib's toughest fight in the UFC, considering his skill set, the fact that he's a great wrestler, a tremendous striker, a very powerful striker. Yeah, this has all the makings. And, oh, by the way, on top of all that, Khabib is telling us, like, hey, I might have one or two left, max. And so you start to think, like, whoa, this is ending already? And you start to appreciate it more, and it all feels like a bigger deal. He fights essentially once a year these days, and distance makes the heart grow fonder. Now, all of a sudden, every time he reemerges, it feels like a bigger and bigger deal.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. And Ariel, you mentioned the loss of his father. Do you have any kind of sense, and I don't want to say this respectfully, but do you have any sense as to where he is emotionally and psychologically following the death of his father, who was also his best friend, his mentor, and his coach?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. And I know that it is, you know, this is part of our job, right? Like, we all remember Brett Favre playing, what was it, like 24 hours after his father passed away on Monday Night Football. Like, this is just a part of sports. Athletes are humans and all this stuff. It does feel a little uncomfortable that, like, his father gets used sometimes as a storyline, but I understand why that's happening. I'll just say this. To me, and from talking to people close to him and from just kind of observing him, it does feel like he is very determined and very motivated to do this for his father. Now, if you're wondering how it will affect him, like as far as X's and O's on Saturday, his father was actually only in his corner for one UFC fight. He had a visa issue, and the last time he was in his corner, the only time he was in his corner, was last September. His most recent fight in Abu Dhabi, he was able to travel from Dagestan to Abu Dhabi, but he couldn't get into the States. And so he's kind of used to fighting without his dad, but obviously this is much different. He's not, you know, he's not here anymore, unfortunately. And so, yeah, I'm curious. I was wondering if he'd come back. I was wondering if he'd say, I don't want to do this. But now it feels like he wants to do this in honor of his dad. And that's a very powerful thing. And they had a deal that he would make it to 30-0 and that maybe he would fight George St. Pierre in his last fight. And all these things are kind of coming to fruition. They're all within reach, I think. And so I think that we're going to see a very determined, a focused Khabib who's wanting to do this for his dad, as opposed to a weak Khabib who's going to use the passing of his father as an excuse or a crutch.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. And then on the other side, you've got Gaethje, and he was just absolutely spectacular in showing up the way he did against Tony Ferguson. If he shows up that way, and again, we're talking about different guys, styles do make fights. If Gaethje shows up the way he did against Ferguson, how tough a fight will that be for Khabib?
Very tough. And I'm happy that you said styles make fights, because at the end of the day, MMA is a very hard sport to predict, because this guy could look amazing against that guy, but then he fights the other guy who beat the guy that he looked amazing against, and then he loses that guy. I mean, it's just
right.
It's a crazy sport like that, right? MMA math can give you a big headache. And so I think, regardless of the matchup, if the Justin Gaethje who showed up against Ferguson, and by the way, the Justin Gaethje who showed up in the three fights prior to that shows up on Saturday, he has a very good chance, because he's turned into a very different fighter than the one who lost two in a row a few years ago in the UFC. He used to be this Tasmanian devil who would walk in there and be okay with getting, you know, two punches to the chin and then handing out three. He liked the firefight. He liked fighting in that phone booth. He liked getting dropped. He was all, like, crazy for that sort of thing, fight of the night, all that stuff. Now he's become a lot more patient, a lot more calm, a lot more cool, collected, a lot smarter. He doesn't take the same kind of damage. And so I think if he can keep this fight in the center of the octagon, not get pressed up against the cage, because that's where Khabib does his best work, not make this a dirty fight like that kind of fight where Khabib presses you up against the cage, takes you down, does the Dagestani handcuff routine, puts his hand over your mouth, what he did to Dustin Poirier. If he can keep it in the center of the octagon, utilize his leg kicks the same way he did against Tony Ferguson, keep him at bay, and then make this into a kickboxing fight, he's got better striking than Khabib. He has more power in his hands than Khabib. Remember, when Khabib fought Conor McGregor and Khabib took Conor down in the center of the octagon, not up against the cage, Conor got back up. And Justin has better takedown defense and better wrestling than Conor. So he'll be able to get back up, I think, as well. And then if he can keep this fight standing and tag Khabib, by the way, the same way Dustin Poirier tagged him in their fight last September, all bets are off. I really do think he has a chance if all those things can happen. Now, I know that's a big if, but I do think he has the skill set to make this into a really interesting fight.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. You know, both these guys also, Ariel, are really interesting personalities. I'm curious, what is your sense as to what each guy thinks of the other?
Total respect, no bad blood, no animosity. In fact, they're both managed by the same guy, a polarizing figure in our sport named Ali Abdelaziz. They're both managed by him. And so they're part of the same sort of team, if you will, family. But obviously, it's not a sparring match. They're going to beat each other. But one really cool thing that happened yesterday, and this has been what Gaethje has said ever since he beat Ferguson, he's not interested in the interim belt. You know, sometimes you'll see a guy win the interim belt or a woman win the interim belt and treat that as if it's the real belt. Heck, Conor McGregor did that. And he did a great job of almost like putting into existence the fact that he was the real champion, even though when he won the interim title against Chad Mendes back at UFC 189, he was the interim champion. He only became the official champ at UFC 194 when he knocked out Jose Aldo. Gaethje is one of those guys who won the interim belt and didn't even put it around his waist, put it on the ground and told Joe Rogan afterwards in May, hey, I'm waiting for the real one. Yesterday at the press conference when they faced off, they gave both of them a belt and Gaethje took it off and said, no, I'm waiting for that one. He's the real champ. I mean, how could you not respect that? How could you not love that? I know Khabib respects it, but I also know that Gaethje's been waiting for this moment a long time. He wants the real one. He's trying to go in and take it tomorrow. No, not tomorrow, Saturday. And by the way, we should remind everyone, I know it's a really busy Saturday, and I know it's Big Ten coming back and all that stuff, but this is an afternoon fight. This is a matinee, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific on ESPN Plus pay-per-view, and I'm not being Mr. Shill company businessman here. I just want the fans to know that this is happening in the afternoon so they don't miss it because it's worth obviously watching.
No, it's actually a very good point. I was going to bring that up. That's a 2 p.m. Eastern fight, 11 Pacific, and that speaks to the size of Khabib's international following, that they would do something like that. You mentioned Conor McGregor, Ariel. What about the fact that he agreed to fight Dustin Poirier on January 23rd and that he wants that fight to take place in Arlington at AT&T Stadium? Exactly where does that fight stand right now?
Well, right now it's not signed. They both kind of verbally agreed, but they haven't put pen to paper. And Dustin hasn't like officially agreed. I know he's kind of shown his hand a little bit on social media saying that he wants to fight, but they're still talking. I don't hate the fight. The fight is a good fight. If Conor wants to fight for the belt, if the UFC wants to put him in a title fight, he should get by a Dustin Poirier. I don't like the fact that it's happening 3 months after Khabib Gaethje. A lot can happen in those 3 months. I think it would have made a lot more sense to have Conor fight in November so he can be fighting around the same time so that they can then come back before Ramadan next year, early April, have that fight. If it's Conor who wins, you do the Conor-Khabib rematch. If it's Gaethje who wins and Conor wins, you do Gaethje-Conor, which is a really big deal. All the possibilities are there. But now that you're having Conor fight 3 months later, I mean, there's a very good chance that, you know, if Khabib wins on Saturday and then Conor wins in January, we don't see the rematch until the fall of next year, and who knows what could happen between now and then. So that to me, look, the UFC won this public battle with Conor. I think it was like this game of one-upmanship and everyone was trying to outdo the other. But the one part that they didn't win, in my opinion, was the date. I think the fight should have happened November 21st. You give the people what they want, and then you have Conor fighting around the same time as the title because you always want to have the top contender fighting around the same time as the belt.
All right, so all that said, where or how would you describe the relationship now between Conor and the UFC?
Oh, and by the way, I didn't really answer your question. I do think right this second it happens in Vegas. They're not looking at Texas AT&T Stadium, I should say, Cowboy Stadium. But again, a lot can happen between now and then. The relationship between Conor and the UFC is in an interesting spot. You know, there's been this misconception over the years that they were all like tight and they were, you know, BFF, kumbaya. That hasn't been the case for the past 4 or so years. You know, the UFC, as you know, they are a very dominant brand and they are led by a dominant ego, right? And that's been part of their success. And they don't like when someone gets bigger than the brand. And you can make a case that Conor is just as big as the brand. Like you could walk down a street in, I don't know, Brussels and ask someone who Conor McGregor is. There's a chance they know who Conor is, but maybe they don't know who the UFC is. That hasn't been the case in the past. He recognizes that. They recognize that. And there's this constant battle to prove that they are, you know, the bosses, right? That they tell Conor what to do. And so that's why they say, all right, you're going to fight on this day. And he's like, no, I want to fight on this day. You're going to fight this guy. I want to fight that guy. Oh, we're going to agree to fight, but I want it to be at AT&T Stadium. Like it's this constant game of back and forth. And so they're not, you know, the best of friends, but they always recognize at the end of the day that there's a lot of money to be made when they are on the same page. So we see this thing happen often. They battle, and then eventually they agree. This is what's happening again. But at some point, once Connor's deal expires, and I believe there's four fights left, things are going to get really interesting. Unless they somehow dramatically fix this relationship, I would say it's probably not trending in the right direction.
It's a fascinating conversation, right? Who has the bigger brand, the UFC or Connor in and of himself?
Who do you think?
He's a journalist for ESPN, the host of several shows and podcasts, etc. And yes, a friend of the program. And remember, Ariel makes a very good point. It is going to be a 2 p.m. Eastern time for the main card, 11 o'clock Pacific. And that's unusual. So make note of that. Ariel, great job. Have an amazing weekend. Great to talk to you about that fight. And I know we'll do it again soon.
And by the way, if you see Chael Sonnen, I haven't seen him or heard from him since I laid the verbal smackdown on him on your program a couple months ago. If you see or hear from him, tell him I'm looking for him. I'm concerned, and I hope he's doing okay.
Ariel, do you think one thing has anything to do with the other? Did you put him to sleep? Did you put him to sleep?
I haven't heard from him, so I would imagine he's either asleep or has just left out of fear for his own safety.
I see it working. All right. If I see him, I will let him know. If, in fact, I see him. Ariel Helwani joining us. All right, then. My man. When we come back, and for the record, I have not seen Chael, nor have I heard from Chael. I don't know, man. Maybe he tapped out on life after what Ariel did to him on this show. All right, coming up, the start of hour number three. Hey, who you got? I say this a lot for big matchups, but who you got? Gaethje or Khabib? Will Brinson next hour. My thoughts on Antonio Brown coming up when we return.